Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, dialogues, healthcare discussion, and answers to your questions and calls, emails, and just about anything else that comes up. So sit back, it's another hour of Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let me start out by giving you an update from the trenches. What's the latest going on with respect to vaccine stuff, all the H1N1, and I've got an in-the-trenches report. Over the last couple of weeks, we've had several unexpected shipments of our H1N1 vaccine, as I have many other medical clinics, and essentially, it's pretty much you have no idea what's coming from day to day. We've had several announcements. Those announcements that we'll be getting a shipment have all been wrong. Then the shipments arrived unexpectedly. And, you know, it's all right. We're getting our patients vaccinated. We're distributing it. But a little bit more predictability would be nice. I have to say that aside, I've been very impressed with people's behavior. I've seen everyone behave like a good citizen, essentially. I haven't seen any people pretend to be pregnant in order to get the vaccine or behave in any kind of belligerence or hostility when told, you know, you're 60 years old, you're probably semi-immune to H1N1. If I have the shot tomorrow, I'm going to give it to the 6-year-old, not the 60-year-old. And people have actually kind of dealt with it. There has been a lot of time talking to people about the vaccine, talking to them about risk-benefit curves, having the same conversation we had here a few weeks ago as the vaccine became available, and having it over and over and over and over again, all the while dealing with your usual tight primary care schedule. Kudos also to all of the nurses and medical assistants out there who have been working their fannies off doing all this extra work, giving people their shots, which is, you know, one or two extra people coming in during a day for a vaccination, not a problem. 30 or 40, well, gets a little disruptive with the workflow. But what are you going to do? Now, the official federal health officials in charge of immunization and respiratory diseases is saying, let's just set up as many outlets as possible. This is Dr. Anne Schuchat. I'm not sure about the pronunciation of that. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She was apparently getting a lot of hassle from the press when it got out that some of the Wall Street banks, including Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, you know, synonymous with Satan at the moment, had received shipments of vaccines while pediatricians' clinics and major hospitals were still waiting for their full allotments. Okay, guys, let's just get the vaccine out there and distribute it. Let's not worry about priorities. I mean, I agree that we want to get it to the pediatric offices as quickly as possible, but let's just get it out there. The more people who are immune, the less likely it is to be distributed. And our distribution system could use some work. That is absolutely true. And that's how I started out. But, you know, we have got so many more important things to be hassling about right now. And I'm certainly welcoming your questions about the H1N1. I'm in practice answering them. So if you have a question about that or actually a question about anything else, give me a call at 476-2800, 1-800-655-5877. Also, on the subject of vaccines, a couple of other things. The human papillomavirus vaccine, the FDA just authorized or suggested that we start giving that to males. This is something that doctors have been waiting to hear what the FDA was going to say about this. This is the Gardasil vaccine, which is protective against type 6, 11, 16, and 18. 16 and 18 types of HPV being the ones that are associated with cervical cancer, and for that matter, penile cancer. But penile cancer is really, really rare. Cervical cancer is really, really common. So essentially, we're going after protecting the sexual partners. But Merck proposed to the FDA that it could be justified in males for the prevention of genital warts, which are caused by the HPV type 6 and 11. And they got a 7-1 in approval from the FDA. It would be authorized for males aged 9 through 26 years. Well, I don't know. It's a $200 vaccine, 3 shots, so a fairly expensive approach for genital warts, but effective. And will it be covered by insurance? Will it be covered by the new health plan that we will have mandated by the government, assuming that something goes through? Open question. Cost-effectiveness issues are going to creep in at that point, but as far as FDA approval is concerned, they think it's justified. And here's another vaccine, not yet FDA approved, but quite promising. This is a vaccine against cocaine. And in about 40% of chronic cocaine addicts, the vaccine was effective, and it lasted about 6 months. The way it works is rather interesting. You get 5 shots of vaccine, and then the people were watched to see whether they stayed cocaine-free. Compared to a group that received placebo shots, the study subjects who received the cocaine vaccine were 45% of the time cocaine-free. And in contrast, the people who did not get vaccine were only 35%. So not a huge improvement, but a treatment that would work for preventing the high on cocaine and therefore reducing the reward loop that keeps addiction in place is certainly a unique and interesting approach. So cocaine vaccine, promising, not ready for prime time, but who knows what the future brings. By the way, just a little FYI for those who didn't know, one of the more effective treatments for addiction of all kinds, but particularly cocaine and opiate addiction, is ear acupuncture. And this has been shown in multiple double-blind studies. In fact, it's a standard part of mandated drug treatment protocols throughout the country. And we're going to Heidi in Palo Colorado Canyon. Hello, Heidi. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a correction for you about something that you said last week.
Go ahead.
You said that Blue Cross was nonprofit, and it actually used to be a nonprofit company, but when everything got deregulated, it became for profit.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected.
I kind of have an interesting story about that. When I buy my own health insurance, which is really expensive and doesn't pay for anything, and when I would get notices in the mail, I would sort of try to keep up on, you know, the changes that it made. And I noticed at some point that it was now a for-profit company. And at that point, you know, I called them and I said, well, what does this mean? And I got various people and I got switched from one person to the other. And no one would answer my question. They got very angry at me.
I bet you were one of the very few people who actually called and said, exactly what does this mean now?
Well, I guess I was, and they just refused to deal with it.
What do you think it means?
Well, for-profit, and the rates just went up astronomically.
Do you recall by what percentage your rates increased the year after it went to for-profit?
You know, it was a long time ago, and I don't remember, but there was a 2-year period of time in which my rates increased 140%.
That might have been the year. One of the things about the difference between for-profit and not-for-profit is what you can do with the leftover money. And in a not-for-profit, you have to plow the leftover money back into the organization. Now, you can set that up so that the staff and particularly the board of directors and the executive officers get really palatial salaries, and that's legal. So a not-for-profit isn't necessarily spending all of that money wisely, but they receive a break on taxation as a result of being not-for-profit, and they can't send money outside of the organization is really the key difference. In the case of a for-profit, you can send as much money outside of the organization as you can squeeze out of the organization. And indeed, I think I see that in healthcare as just a really colossally stupid idea. because it increases the cost of healthcare or of health insurance if you're going to send money to Wall Street. What part of not a good idea was rotating around in Ronald Reagan's head when the Knox-Keene Act came out? I could not tell you. But
it's just that everything seems to be the business model and that the free market would take care of everything, and obviously it hasn't. And Blue Cross, on their individual policies last year, raised their rates between 20% and 43% on some people.
One of the things, just to comment on that I have seen this last 6 months in particular, as it became really clear that healthcare reform of some kind is down the road, I see that there's this last-ditch effort on the part of some of the health plans to squeeze as much money out as they can. And they've stopped even pretending to be nice or having any kind of illusion of cooperation or, yes, we're really trying to do this for the health of the patient. There's this real hardball, we're going to trick you, we're going to give you gotchas, we're going to do everything we can because we know that regulations are coming and we're going to play while we can.
Well, just for people who don't think it's as bad as it is and maybe have their own insurance, I spent $8,000 this year keeping myself insurance and paying my deductible, and I got no help with any treatment or doctor's offices.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that you've had such a high expenditure, but thank you very much for the call.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. And let's go now to Tess in Monterey. Hello, Tess. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm going to change the subject a little bit. I have a child who has mental illness. He is now 18. Here's the problem that we are having. We vacillate between believing he has a mental illness and not. At the moment, he just had a psychotic break, and so I believe it. What happens is, and I consider myself a well-educated, intelligent person, but when he's well, when he is medicated and he's doing well, it's almost as if I think, gee, that was the longest bad dream I ever had. You know, this kid's fine. And it just defies logic. But honest to God, I feel this way every single time that this child is medicated and behaving well. And I wish more than anything, and I know there's no way to do this, I wish that he had something where you could take a test and it could be definitively defined by a blood sample. Because what's happening is he's doing the same thing. He goes on and off the medications all the time. He's homeless part of the time. He'll disappear for a week at a time. I don't know. Maybe you can tell me, is there a test? Is there anything that would help him understand or help me understand that he is truly sick, very sick child, and that he needs to be on his medication?
Wow. Okay. Well, yes, to answer your question, there is a test or a... You're really looking for a demonstration is what I'm hearing. You want to...
Well, something besides just behavioral.
Right,
just
right.
Evidence.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
so difficult.
Let me stop you and say that you can see very easily, there are a couple of brain imaging techniques that look at basically where the brain is burning calories effectively. And one of them is called a PET scanner. You get these beautiful multicolored pictures of the brain that are color-coded for brain activity. And so you can see parts of the brain light up and turn up bright. You usually use bright yellow for the highest area of blood flow and glucose use. And you can see in a person, let's say that we're talking about a schizophrenic condition, you can see when the person is off of their meds and having schizophrenic behavior, you can see the different parts of the brain, essentially the prefrontal lobes, which are where you do your executive functioning, cool down because they're not working as much, and other parts of the brain light up. So you can have a nice picture. You know, this is your brain on meds, and this is your brain when you're acting crazy, and put them up on the wall and hope that that penetrates. Unfortunately, it probably won't work because the first thing that goes is your judgment and your insight. As you start to slip into psychosis, the very first thing you do is lose your judgment and lose your insight. And so the dry mouth or whatever minor or major side effects you might be experiencing from the medications becomes predominant in your mind. Plus, there's a sort of endorphin rush that is pleasurable. And so you kind of get a reward pathway loop going into the psychotic state, I think, in some people anyway. Of course, once they're floridly psychotic, they're unhappy. But it's very difficult to get the person to stay on their meds. And we've been working, science has been working on figuring out treatments for this. There are a couple of strategies. One strategy that's actually fairly promising is give the drugs by a shot.
And we are doing that now because he isn't consistent taking the medications.
Yeah, and that works. It's called depot dosing.
Yes.
And you can do it with hormones. You mix them with oil so that they're absorbed. You don't get perfect absorption. You get some peaks and troughs, but it's certainly better for people who aren't taking it. I wish that we could invent some sort of color change, ultraviolet light would show a certain color to the base of your fingernails if you were taking the drug or something like that. Wouldn't that be nice? Because then you'd know whether the person had stopped their meds before they started behaving as if they'd stopped their meds.
I
feel so badly for you because you're in the position now also. You refer to him as your child, but you're talking about an 18-year-old man who's nominally a free agent.
He's a free agent, and this is exactly what happened. The minute he turned 18, we have no access to his records. We have to get his permission, and when he's in a lucid state, he is cooperative about that. But when he's not, he disappears. So we get a call from San Francisco, or we get a call in Berkeley, or something will happen. He'll turn up.
Have you talked to an attorney?
I haven't. However, I have not done that yet, because when he's in a medicated and functioning, he never functions perfectly, but he functions better. It's just heartbreaking to think of conserving him or doing something that restrictive, because he's a bright young man. But when you talk about executive functions, oh my God, they're the first thing to go. Mm-hmm. He can't function. He can barely bathe. He came home this last time. His teeth look like, I seriously think he's going to lose his teeth. He can't function. He literally cannot function.
It's a very serious thing.
It's the saddest thing I've ever seen, because it's not something that people can see. Like somebody walking with a cane, they're blind, or someone doesn't have any arms. It's an invisible illness, and it is devastating. It's devastated his life.
Not just his. Thank you very much for the call, and I would suggest you speak with an attorney. You don't necessarily have to do a tough conservatorship, but it gives you leverage, and it'll get you access to the records. And so think about it, okay?
I will do that, and thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
We're going now to Juan in Salinas. Hello, Juan, and welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you again?
Good.
Hey, listen, I just wanted to get your opinion on, this whole healthcare reform thing. I got an email from, I can't remember what organization, saying that Nancy Pelosi was turning her back on some vital parts of the reform, and I don't remember the number. Very vital part of it that was, I don't know if it had anything to do with the public option, but I just wanted to know what your take on that is. Is it true? Are Democrats being a little softer than they're supposed to be, or what's your take on this whole thing, or have you heard anything about it?
Well, I have to admit to a certain amount of disappointment with our democratic process, if we can call what's going on in Congress right now a democratic process. Democrats, Republicans, I don't know what those words mean anymore. There are these guys who are in office they're elected. The weird thing about this is that if you come from the South, then the term Democrat means something very different than if you come from Vermont, and ditto, Republican. So politics is local, and I guess the people who go to Washington are doing their very best to get reelected, which means representing the local, or how their read on the local people. But the problem really is that people are thinking about locally, they're thinking about their self-interest, and nobody's really got a big picture view. And when they get to Washington, where they need to have a big picture view, they are bound by their concerns about reelection and this huge distorted money thing that the corporations love, because it allows them to just, they were talking this morning, in fact, on the radio about all the corporation has to do is threaten to finance an opponent in the next election, and you'll change your vote if you want to be reelected. And people will tend to act to keep their jobs. And this is where we need, right now with health reform, we need courage. We need someone to take a longer than 5-year view. We need someone to take a 20-year view. And nobody can do it. Even the people who want to do it are stuck with these short-term loop congressmen and senators whose real focus is re-election first and everything else second.
Well,
and
the lobbying,
it makes me sick. It does.
Well, the lobbying efforts, from what I understand, by the pharmaceuticals are unprecedented. $900 million were invested last month alone.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. This has been the biggest, healthcare reform has been the biggest money tree for the people who are in Congress and in the Senate. It's just an insane amount of money going into donations and into political action committees. And, you know, when people are working that hard, when the corporation as a collective monolith joins together and works this hard against something, I'm all for it automatically, because anything corporate America is so scared of is probably good for the people.
Correct. Yeah, I agree.
It's kind of predator-prey, okay? We've got a situation where we're the herbivores, okay? We're the antelope on the savanna, and they're the lions and the tigers. And they come around and they, you know, munch on us, like that woman who's paying $8,000 a year out of her own pocket for basically to be protected against something disastrous, but otherwise she's getting nothing. She's a gazelle with a limp. You know, she's going down. The tigers are like, oh, we got her. She's, you know, she's self-employed. She's going down. And our government basically is kind of the guy in the center of the herd who's like totally safe from the predators and going, oh, well, we lost one over there, but we got plenty of gazelles left, so we're good as a species.
Good analogy, but scary.
Well, that's how it feels, I guess. I guess I should say this, all right? I'm normally a fairly optimistic person, and so I'm pessimistic that we're going to make the kind of strides we should to covering the uninsured. I'm pessimistic that the benefit package that gets mandated will be adequate. I'm optimistic that pre-existing conditions go away, and I'm optimistic that the people who are 45, have hay fever, and are self-employed are going to be the gazelle with the limp anymore. They will actually be able to buy coverage through a pool or through some kind of public plan or somehow, somewhere, those individuals who have been so unfairly stigmatized, well, basically ripped off, will get some reform. But the poor, the people with marginal incomes, the young, I think it's going to be a tax on them.
Right. Well, let's pray. Let's hope that you said, that there's some courage in there and somebody, some poor schmuck in Congress realizes there's really a bigger deed to be done.
You got any family in the south, east of the United States?
No, I'm Mexican-American. All my family's south of the border.
Okay. Because the people that really need to be writing letters are the people in the south, in the southern states, because it's the southern Democrats that are going to make or break this.
Yeah, but you know what the funny part is? I was reading an article in Rolling Stone, is those folks in the South, the ones that need it the most, it's almost like they're right there with corporate America. They're being fleeced, and they're the ones that need it the most. So it's kind of an irony. They're saying, nope, we don't want the government involved in this. We don't want them to do this.
I know.
So,
get the government.
They're the ones that need it.
Get the government out of my Medicare, right?
Exactly. So,
okay, well, thank you for your call.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to an anonymous caller.
Oh, hi. This is an 81-year-old living in Santa Cruz County. I'm trying to understand a doctor's either inability to, or for whatever reason, does not tell a patient, and I'm the patient, what is the name of the problem that he is treating. And I have no real gripe about it. I guess it's my ego. I would like to know what the name of the disease is. I am now assuming that it is psoriasis. I have lumps, you know, that are going away, and I'm getting better, and I'm getting medicine that he prescribed, two of them. One of them is for when I have an extreme rash, and that's called Nutraderm lotion. Nutraderm lotion, and the other one is Aquaphor, Aquaphor. Am I correct in assuming that psoriasis is what I'm being treated for?
You can't make that assumption based on the medications.
Oh.
Okay. You could be psoriasis, but there are a number of other conditions, different types of dermatitis,
I have little lumps all over my body and kind of crazy, but I was thinking yesterday if I had like a sliver or something, I would sterilize a needle and press these little lumps and get the clear stuff out of what's inside.
Don't do that.
I thought they were mosquito bites when I first got this.
But don't do that, all right? Don't do that. I have a patient who got herself into such trouble that trying to do that recently.
Oh.
And she sterilized the needle, but she forgot to sterilize her skin. And she gave herself a horrible abscess.
And, you know, before in the acute form of this disease, I had looked on both underarms from my elbow to the where my underneath my shoulder, there was streaks of red coming up. That's what got me to the doctor in the first place.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you and just say that let's go back to your original question.
Yeah.
All right. Which was, why won't my doctor name it?
Yeah.
And the reason is, I suspect, is that the doctor is not certain how to name it because it's nonspecific enough that there are four or five possibilities.
Oh.
And what I do in that circumstance as a physician is I go, well, I could biopsy the person. I could punch a hole in them and send it off to the pathologist and maybe I would get a definitive answer, but is that going to change my treatment, I say to myself.
And I'm getting better, so I'm not complaining.
Yeah, no, and that's the point. The treatment for most of the things it could be is exactly the same.
Oh.
So I would do what I believe your doctor has done and say, well, I'm not exactly sure which of these four entities it is, but the treatment for them is all the same, so let's treat it, and if it doesn't get better, then I'll biopsy it.
Oh, I see.
But if it gets better, then it doesn't really matter what name it has. Now, we have a passion for naming things because then we can go look them up online, for one thing.
Yeah.
And also, when people have something that can't be named, then they don't know what to expect. They don't know, is it going to come back? Is it going to get worse? Is it a sign of cancer? And your head goes crazy with you. You're like, oh my God, is this one of these cutaneous manifestations of malignancy?
Yeah.
And the answer is, yeah, maybe it is. I'm not looking at your skin, but I'm just saying.
Yeah, or it could be anything. But the one thing that I do notice, I'm a person that's very physically active for my age. People look at me and they think I'm at least 10 years younger than I really am.
Does it get worse when you're physically active?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Ah, that's my question. I got so bad after I cleaned up my place. I mean, outside, raking and, you know, leaves and all this other stuff.
Well, I'm thinking that when you exercise, if you stop and think what happens, you sweat.
Yes.
So is there a sweat gland issue? I'm just free associating right now.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that happens when you exercise is you have increased heat in your body.
Yeah.
And so you put more blood out to the skin. So some people will develop autoimmune reactions. Those will flare with exercise. Some people will have a antibody reaction against a food or a drug they're taking.
Yeah.
And those will get worse with exercise. Sometimes you'll even see that when people are swallowing enough pollen, like if they're allergic to redwood pollen and they're running through the redwoods, they'll actually get a rash rather than an asthma attack or a sneezing attack because they've swallowed so much pollen and it gets into their stomach. And if their stomach, if they take, let's say, ibuprofen, or they have some other problem with their barrier in their intestines, that'll get into their bloodstream, and their immune system will attack it. Before you know it, they break out in a rash.
Yeah. Is there a specific vitamin that I should take?
No, I can't really say. I can't really say that.
Going along
like you've been going on. You're getting better.
Yeah.
And if you,
I just don't want to get it again.
I understand. Well, you're local, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if it happens again and flares up badly, ask your doctor, who I presume is a regular primary care internist.
An internist, yeah.
Right. Ask your doctor to get you in to see a dermatologist while it's at its worst.
Oh.
And then dermatologists are like little visual encyclopedias.
Yeah.
That's what they do. That's their expertise. It's like the 10-second, they look at it and they go, oh, it's this.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the time they're right, way, way more than I am or any internist would be.
Yeah, and seeing it is worth $1 million, I guess. You know.
Exactly. So
Thank you for talking to me.
Good luck.
Okay, now bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Andrew Weil right now is under fire by the FDA and the FTC.
For?
For using natural remedies such as astragalus, which is used traditionally to ward off colds and flu, and has demonstrated both antiviral and immune-boosting effects in scientific investigations.
Yes, that's true. So what did he do exactly that got the FDA down on him? Did he say on a website or something that it could help prevent influenza? Because that would that would be the one that they're going after big time right now. I'll tell you why they're doing that. I'm sorry that Dr. Weil got caught in the net. You know how the government is. It's sort of all or nothing, mostly nothing, but every now and then they decide to go crazy and then they get nuts. But they're worried about people who are actually profiteering. And there's some very, very unscrupulous people out there right now on the internet selling, you know, protection from the influenza. Like, you don't need a flu shot. Here, take this herb and you'll be protected.
Taking advantage of the opportunity.
Yeah, and they're selling snake oil or something that's maybe a little better than snake oil, but is absolutely unproven in terms of the assertions that they're making. So I suspect that somebody in Bethesda, Maryland, does a Google search where they put the word flu and natural in the same sentence and look at every website that puts those two words within 10 words of each other and decides whether or not to slap them with a warning or a fine. In that group, they will hit some very unscrupulous people, and they will also hit some very well-meaning, ethical people. Just a little riff on Andrew Weil for a moment, because Andrew Weil has been around for a very, very long time, and he has a very legitimate and, I think, well-thought-out approach to alternative healthcare. And he has, from the very, very beginning, fallen afoul of merchandising and what looks like profiteering. I don't actually see him as a profiteer. I expect he's a fairly rich man, given his prominence and all of that. But I also think he's done a lot of good work, and he's set up a residency program down in Tucson, which I looked into, and it's extraordinarily expensive, like $15,000 a year, way beyond my means to do. And he is this bizarre mix of showman and profit center and really good information. I have this kind of love-hate feel about him that I have about Deepak Chopra, in that they are a little too big and a little too slick, and there's a little bit too much money being made on information that they themselves did not produce. They put it together. It's been out there. Yes, they packaged it, much in the way I package information, but they've got really good marketing people. And I guess marketing makes me itch, like that last caller who, when she exercises, she gets a rash. Marketing gives me a rash. So I'm always in a love-hate relationship with doctors like this.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because it's all throughout history, it's always been a strange mixture, you know, of business and medicine. It's the same as business and art.
Actually, that's a very good analogy. I think there is a great similarity there. Yeah. So you would know exactly what I'm talking about then.
So there definitely is something to that. But in the same way, he does quite a bit for nonprofit, right?
Yes, he does. He does.
And he also does a lot for, you know, things like organic farming and, you know, keeping the air clean. And I feel that if he is making money, well, good for him. Better him than some doctor who's out there prescribing drugs that are more harmful than they are good. If he's, you know, promoting naturalism, maybe we need more people like him.
Exactly. So
that is,
I think we've had the discussion.
Complex.
Yeah. Did you have anything besides where we've gone before, any last words before I go to the next caller?
Is this a trend that the government is kind of going after things that are natural, and the synthetic things are the things that are going to be promoted?
No, I don't think it's a trend yet. I think this is a blip. I think that could happen. But the last time that the government tried to go after things that were natural, it backfired really badly. That was in 1994. Do you remember that? You remember there was like, oh, the government's going to regulate vitamins and supplements?
Yeah, it backfired.
Oh, boy, did it backfire. In fact, what little protections there were got removed, and now we all have to go to sites like Consumer Lab in order to figure out whether or not what we're buying actually has what it says it has in it. So all testing got alleviated. Even the
testing like for lead and toxicants, which, as far as I'm concerned, if you're selling a pill, you should be forced to be monitoring that for lead. And if you don't have a certificate that says that you've checked your product for lead, you should be put out of business. I shouldn't be at risk for contamination just because you don't want to spend the extra money to validate that your product is safe. But right now, you don't have to do that.
Yes.
So,
I was wondering about vitamin E. I read about a controversy with vitamin E where vitamin E is actually counterproductive.
No.
Is that
that was
the
DL and the... it was a setup. Basically, short version, cliff note version of this. The studies that show that vitamin E is good for your heart and good for your brain and a potent antioxidant come in two varieties, epidemiological and test tube. The epidemiologic studies are all looking at your diet. They're not looking at taking a vitamin D supplement. They're looking at diets that contain foods high in vitamin E. If you eat that diet, you have less Alzheimer's, you have less heart disease, you have less cancer. Trouble is, there's a lot of things in that diet besides vitamin E. And there are some peculiarities about dietary vitamin E that are different from supplement vitamin E. So supplement vitamin E in the scientific studies that failed to show a benefit, and in fact showed a mild trend towards harm, they were using an unbalanced form of vitamin E that was just one of about six isomers that are found in food. So they were using alpha-tocopherol exclusively. Now, they use that one because that's the one we can measure in the blood. So we can do blood levels, and then we can be all scientific. We can get the blood level up to 500 or so, and then say, all right, this is the highest quartile of vitamin E, and we're going to monitor them for strokes and heart disease. Problem is, diet, you're looking at vitamin E in the form of alpha-tocopherol, gamma-tocopherol, delta-tocopherol, etc. And those go somewhere. We put them into the stomach, and they can't be found in the bloodstream. They are absorbed by the body tissues, and they go somewhere. So they're not very good scientifically because you can't monitor the dose level you're getting. On the other hand, if you load someone with a lot of vitamin alpha tocopherol and don't give them any gamma and delta, given that the body evidently has something that it needs the gamma and delta for, as evidenced by the fact that it doesn't circulate in the bloodstream very long, you're sort of not doing the same thing as what those early epidemiologic studies looking at diet were doing. So that being said, when I tell someone to take a vitamin E, I'm telling them to take a mixed tocopherol, something that has the gamma and the delta, because I figure if you're going to try to do it with a pill rather than doing it with the food, which is better, by the way, it's better to do it with the food, but if you're going to try to do it with a pill, at least do it with the pill that mimics as closely as possible what nature's providing. All right? Fair enough?
All said.
All right. You have a good day.
It should be true of all vitamins. How does that sound?
I think that we will someday understand that it's better to eat the food. But in the short term, we've still got a pharmaceutical mentality. Let's turn it into a product that we can sell. And it's much easier to sell a pill than it is to sell a diet that people will actually do rather than, you know, just kind of buy the book and put it on the shelf. I have so many books I haven't read. And there's a sort of act of faith. You buy the book that's kind of magical. You think the knowledge is going to jump from the pages into your brain. It never does. But I think diet books are a little bit like that. They're a very popular form of literature. And I have a feeling that it's because people really want to lose weight. So they buy the diet book.
I'm just the opposite. I'm trying to gain weight.
Well, good luck to you.
One thing for flu.
One last thing.
It's good to keep your nose clean with salt water and to gargle with salt water.
Totally on there, yes. It's true. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We had an off-air comment about mercury in vitamin E and omega fatty acid pills. Yes, mercury can be found in some vitamins as a contaminant. Most quality firms do check for that, but there is, as I said, no requirement that that be done. And that requirement used to be there. It was removed. The last time Congress looked at regulating vitamins, they ended up essentially defanging the existing, everyone agreed it was inadequate regulation, and they made it worse. I'm worried about that happening again on healthcare reform. And certainly, once you open the box, the corporations move in, and the defanging process is certainly a possibility here. We've got the mandate. That's well supported by the corporations. The public option, and regulations on policies and restrictions on the sorts of egregious practices that these companies have gotten away with for a decade? Well, not so much. Stay tuned. And we're going to talk to Bill in Santa Cruz. Hello, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes, I had a question on the authority in a behavioral, like a BHU unit, mm-hmm. to force an individual to take a dangerous antipsychotic. Mm-hmm. I was forced to Zyprexa, which olanzapine. Zyprexa is a brand name recently, right. Without even an evaluation. As soon as I walked in the door, my sons were asking me to just go in and get checked up because I had my evidence that I sent in a registered letter to VA was like lost for 10 months. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to do this myself because I couldn't find help. But there was no interest in what my despair was at all. It was just as soon as I went in, you're taking Zyprexa, Haldol, Ativan, and Depakote. And I said, no, you have no right. The VA has never forced any medication. Mm-hmm. So
let me ask a technical question.
Yes.
Here. Because your question is it legal for
right.
them to force you to take a drug?
Well, I have the law. If you're a danger,
yes,
considered a
exactly.
danger.
Exactly.
And that was how that became a basis when my son, I went in voluntarily for like to see my health because I.
Okay. I'm going to interrupt you and say,
go ahead.
This is how it happens. Mm-hmm. Is you go and present yourself at a mental health unit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, there's a series of questions that the psychiatrist or the intake person who might be a tech, but they've got special training in psychiatric evaluation. And it's kind of silly. It's sort of a checklist of things. But what they're looking for are insight and judgment and whether or not there's a thought disorder present. So if you came in, for example, wearing an aluminum hat and it wasn't Halloween and the person asked you, why are you wearing an aluminum hat? And you said, because it blocks the radio transmission from Washington, which are otherwise...
Well, yeah, delusional stuff. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Now, the person who says that, it's sitting there in their aluminum hat. This is, to them, it seems at that moment in time, a completely reasonable strategy because they are hearing things and they've come up with this explanation. And when they put the hat on, it works because it is, of course, all being generated in their brain. So if you, at the time that you presented, had, an inappropriate thought pattern or maybe your sons reported some inappropriate behavior or some inappropriate patterns, and they may not have necessarily shared with you everything they said to the doctor. I don't know.
No, I've talked with
Yeah, I don't know the situation.
Yeah.
But I'm just giving you a general commentary.
No, the only thing,
but
yeah.
a healthcare professional who's duly licensed and certified will make the assessment, yes, this person is a danger to themselves or others, or they are gravely disabled, and that's the other one.
Both.
So if you have gravely disabled, that means you're not violent, you aren't threatening violence, but you're wearing the aluminum hat, so you're gravely disabled because your thought processes are not part of consensual reality. And in the 70s and 80s, there was a great deal of debate about whether this was actually a meaningful distinction. And, I could argue the point on either side because I think it's a wonderful argument, what exactly is sanity. But
I was just terrified of psychiatric drugs. I've had
yes,
problems
I
under- with them before.
And
that's what it
and
was.
They are terrifying because they do have significant side effects. We use them anyway because the benefit outweighs the risk in the assessment of the physician.
Well, this is my health, though, and I'm saying that this is a fatal drug or it can be a permanent disabled drug, and why do they resort to that?
I mean, because we don't have anything better. And if a person is delusional or psychotic,
what if there's a misdiagnosis?
Then you've got a misdiagnosis and an injustice, and good luck proving it.
Well, yeah, I got to go through the district attorney. That's what I'm trying to do.
Your credibility is going to be fairly low, though. I mean, it's really a catch-22 situation.
Why would my credibility, you mean by the judgment of the,
I think,
through the rehearing and everything like that? Because they didn't even consult family or anything about the situation.
I understand. I'm just telling you that you've got an uphill climb there.
Okay, so the power is in their hands, and I'm saying it's a hazard for a lot of vets coming back mm-hmm. that are committing suicide where they're not getting help. They're just being prejudged as wearing an aluminum hat. When
yes.
there's things, when they're not a danger, they need a different focus and a different doctor, probably.
I think what we need is better mental health services for everybody, but especially
for
returning veterans.
The nurses were exceptional. The nurses are the saviors in my eye.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm sorry about your negative experience, and I hope you're doing better now. It sounds like the despair is gone.
I don't take any medication.
It sounds like you're doing better.
Yeah.
So thank you for the call.
Okay.
And thank you for your
service. Info,
Thank you for your service.
I'm just worried about kids coming back. So many, 300 a month, it ain't working. So.
I'm worried about them, too.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's talk to Patrick in Santa Cruz. Hello, Patrick, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I had a question regarding diet and weight gain.
Okay, go ahead.
The callers back that mentioned a brief little comment about it, and I was just curious on how to actually gain weight healthily. I follow a vegetarian diet with eating fish occasionally, but it just seems to be, I'm losing more weight than I'm actually gaining. I'm just curious on how to do that.
Well, the best way to gain weight is to eat a diet high in good beneficial fats. And this is omega-3s, so you can get those from nuts. So when I have a vegetarian who's trying to gain weight, I ask them to consume more oil that's cold-pressed, cold-expelled from nuts sources. Walnut oil, for example, or olive oil, olives are not a nut, but you get my point.
Right.
So these are good and generally heart-healthy ways of increasing fat in the diet. And fat will be burnt, but mostly it will go into storage. And so if you're trying to gain weight. Now, as you do this, you should also be doing some kind of protein source, either soy protein or whey protein, but some form of high-dose protein. And you should be working your muscles so that you stimulate the production of muscle tissue versus getting your body fat to muscle ratio thrown off. So as you try to gain weight, you want to eat lots of protein, eat lots of fat, essentially force your body to burn the fat and use the protein to build muscle. So weightlifting, not super strenuous, but the 10 reps, the 10, 15 reps, three times a week kind of weightlifting. Okay, good luck. A lot of people would like to have Patrick's problem. Let's go to Julius in Los Angeles. Hello, Julius. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. I called up to ask you about my leg, but I think I have to change my topic, if that's okay.
Well, we've got about 5 minutes, so let's do what we can do.
All right. The guy was talking about delusion and, the VA. First, I got to say, back him up. The VA is so incredibly evil, right? They abuse you, and then they try to make you think you're crazy because you complain about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's their favorite game to play, and they're pathological liars. They just tell the most unbelievable lies right to your face, like you're so insane you're going to believe it, right? Or it's like they're trying to make you think you're insane or make you insane or something. I don't know what they're trying to do, right?
There was an experiment back in the 70s where some psychiatrists, they were student psychiatrists, and they went to the mental health system, and they were told to say that they heard the word thud. That was their mental illness. They went in and they said, I'm hearing this voice and it keeps saying thud. That was it.
Right.
They thought they would just go with something really neutral. Once these people were committed, they could not prove themselves to be sane because the filter, they could not pass a sanity test. Once they were in the mental health unit, the psychiatrists and the psychiatric nurses were all convinced that they were psychotic. And they were behaving normally, and these are people who are educated. There was a book written about it. I don't have the title of the book, but it was a fascinating example of how once you're into the mental health system and you're labeled, then
that label
creates its own filter, and it's not just the VA.
What he was talking about is terrifying to me because I have to deal with a VA psychologist and a VA caseworker.
Yeah.
And, that's really a veteran's biggest fear, right? I don't know, this is hard for me to say, but I was diagnosed as being delusional because I said that I don't believe that 10 plus 9 equals 10, right? Now, the psychiatrist who diagnosed me as being delusional said that she doesn't believe that Einstein ever said that. She believes that's just part of my delusion, that I made it up, right? Einstein said the mathematical equivalent of that. He said C plus V equals C, right? And she could have found out with one phone call to a physicist that I was telling the truth, but she just decided I'll just diagnose him as being delusional instead, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they
that was her, well, it was her filter set too. And
well,
don't tell a joke to a psychiatrist either, because they're like, "What do you mean by that?"
Right. Well,
it's a joke.
You know, it, well, like, what did he mean by hello? Right.
Yes. Did you really mean hello, or were you just pretending to be sane?
Was it a secret message in there? You know. But anyway, it's like anybody on this planet can find anybody else being delusional if they don't believe in what they believe in, right? I mean, a lot of people would say that people who believe in God are delusional, right? And they should be institutionalized, right? Some people truly believe that, right?
Well, or don't believe in the right God. Let's not forget about all of the religious wars that are currently taking place on the planet. But to come around to your original point, I think that I do fear for the returning veterans and for the vast numbers of people who are getting messed up by being deployed into one of the most psychologically unwholesome environments. That
I heard a captain say yesterday, that a captain on the radio, he used to be a captain in the Army, and he said one of the games the military is playing is trying to get veterans to go along with something which will deny them benefits for their PTSD later, right? And if they don't go along with this, whatever program, that, you know, they may be classified as troublemakers or delusional or whatever, right? And those captain was saying maybe this psychiatrist who went crazy and shot all those people, right? Maybe he was harassed because he wouldn't go along with this program to screw veterans or, you know, wound PTSD soldiers out of their disability later, right? Maybe he wouldn't go along with that program.
You know, Julius, we're out of time, but I just want to leave you with a question. Are you paranoid if they really are out to get you?
There you go. I mean, given what I've been through, I have to be paranoid.
All right. Well,
no
thank
choice.
You for the call. Bye-bye. We've come to the end of another hour of Ask Dr. Don. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.